Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We are at the Georgia State University Language Research Center, we being Bill Russell and I, with Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, talking about science. Well, I find science kind of off-putting as a subject because it's sort of one of those places where people go and hide out and do work that I don't understand. And I think a lot of people feel that way about science, that it's a priesthood. And I, since I don't speak that language and I'm not mathematical, that I'm not...
Numerophobic, I think.
Numerophobic, yeah. Well, yes, I am. I'm also technophobic. Thank you very much. That being the case, when you talk about being inside science and being faced with... I guess I don't think of science as being political. I don't think of science as being sort of like religion, that you there's in and out, there's orthodox and not. And I'm hearing you say that talking about primates who are biologically very close to us, in ways that you attribute thought to them, is sort of a bad idea if you want to be politically correct among the people who do science. Yes?
Well, yes, that's true, because you're supposed to be able, if you're a scientist, to reduce everything to numbers and to unbiased observations. Now, if you're a physicist or a chemist, this is pretty easy to do. But if you're talking about interactive behavior, the conversation you had yesterday with a neighbor across the fence, how are you going to reduce that to a set of meaningful numbers? It's very difficult. And when I try to reduce what I do with the bonobos or the chimpanzees to a set of numbers, then those numbers fail to convey to people the essence of what's really going on, which is one of the reasons I'm trying now to communicate more with videotape. And I find that the videotapes I've made of the bonobos and their communicative skills are really, really interesting to 3- and 4-year-olds. Without any introduction at all, 3- and 4-year-olds ask repeatedly to see my tape over and over again.
And to what do you attribute that?
I think that they're very responsive to the nonverbal communicative signals that they can easily process that the bonobos are giving out, because when you're 3 or 4, you're not such a proficient language user. You can use language, but you're dependent a lot more on facial expression. And if you actually watch 3- and 4-year-olds, you will find that up until about 7, I think, or 8, the face of the young human child is extremely expressive, very much more labile than that of the adult.
Labile, it moves around a lot.
It moves around quickly. Yeah. It shows the emotions in a split-second manner that the child is feeling. As we grow older, we learn to hide those emotions, mm-hmm. not to express them, sometimes even to ourselves. That's how we avoid expressing them on our face. Mm-hmm. So we don't know moment by moment how the other person feels.
But children still are small human primates, still have that skill and have that in common with our cousins, the great apes? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
I think so, and they like to watch tapes of apes for that reason, and apes also like very much to watch tapes of human children. They also...
I'm going to use the U word. Do they understand each other?
Well,
Paula,
here,
do we understand one another?
Well, of course, that's a very good question. Do humans understand each other?
If apes and humans could be permitted to interact with children who are very young, we could answer that question. Right now, children really aren't permitted to be around the apes.
So why is that? Liability? Are we talking...
Partially for liability and partially for worries that the apes might get some childhood disease or something of that sort as well.
And this really is to protect both sides. It's not just... We're not just looking after the children, the humanoid children.
Well, this is a rule that was in effect when I came into the field, so it's not something I've set down. It's just something I
that's
just,
that's real curious.
I want to make a minor digression. I don't want to get too far off on it, but in looking at the work you've done and some of the challenges you've faced, part of it seems to go to the whole issue of the so-called, and this is my own agenda, but the so-called social sciences and the substrate, the evidence that we're looking to find. The physical sciences, you're dealing with physical, tangible objects that are readily definable. Their experiments are readily repeatable. Once you get into the social sciences, any of them, it seems that the practice of science becomes much more problematic, that you're dealing with more intangibles, and you're dealing, you know, forgive me saying, you're dealing with a much more complex set of elements and a much more complex set of interactions between and among those elements. And in some ways, aren't you, you know, isn't part of your challenge just the challenge, the more general challenge of the scientific basis of the social sciences?
I think initially I didn't set out to do that, but it will come to that point. And actually, physics now has come to that point where we say the observer affects what's being observed. And certainly, in any interaction that I participate in with other human beings or with bonobos, I affect that interaction. And much more importantly, not only do I affect it, I can't avoid being a participant. Even if I'm standing there with a video camera, I'm still affecting it, and I'm still a participant. And that interaction will never repeat itself. No interaction between bonobos or between human beings ever repeats itself, unless it's planned for television or something, or a play. It never repeats itself.
And it's still different. No performance is ever the
same.
That's
true. Well,
but everything is different. The symphony between Thursday and Friday night, a one-man, one-woman show between Thursday and Friday night. It's a different show.
And the expectation in science, in the physical science, is that you can do experiments and those experiments are predictable. And if you have a good theory, you can predict what those experiments, what the outcome of those experiments will be every time.
And then you can repeat them.
And that doesn't sound characteristic of, you know, what you're describing. It also doesn't sound characteristic of social sciences.
Are you saying that you're changing the questions that you're asking?
I am trying to change how questions are asked, at least within the fields of animal behavior and primatology. I am trying to say that we are off base when we ask a question like, does an animal have an intent? We must do 1,000 experiments to prove that this animal intends to do what it is obviously and apparently doing.
Mm-hmm.
We should presume, on the other hand, that behavior of our closest living relatives, at least, is extraordinarily complex, that they think, that they pretend, that they have intentionality, that they have goals, and we should try to understand that in the same way that we try to understand another culture. And to do that, we're going to have to start with a more complex hypothesis. We're going to have to say, for example, they have certain kinds of social rules and mores, and these rules and mores might be X, Y, and Z. That's a testable hypothesis. One person can have certain views, another scientist can have other views. You can pit your views against a body of behavioral data from looking at a group of apes. But instead, we've started at the bargain basement and said we have to prove that they have anything. And that's kept
us. And again,
us in
the questions that we pursue are going to shape the answers that we get, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And if we assume that animals don't have minds and they can't think, and we have to do an experiment to prove that they think, the constraints are such on animal experiments that if they were done with human beings, we would conclude that human beings don't think.
Like
that
what?
They don't have purposes, that they don't have intents.
You mean if we were to put the same people through the same experiments we put apes through, that we would look stupid?
We would look stupid if we weren't allowed to use language to explain, well, I think about this, I think about that. For example, Pambanisha
is the younger of the two bonobo chimps whom you have raised.
That's
correct. And have...
With language.
I'm going to say have language.
That's correct. Now, we have the word think on the keyboard. And for a long time, Kanzi and Pambanisha didn't understand if you said, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about this? Are you thinking about that? You would draw a blank as though they didn't understand the question. But when they reach about 6 or 7 years of age, you can say, are you thinking about this? And they'll go, woo, woo. Are you thinking about that? And they may be very quiet and not answer. And now you can even ask Pambanisha, what are you thinking about? And you get a variety of different answers.
Depends on what she's thinking about.
Depends on what she's thinking about.
Again, thinking about folks listening. There must be people who just think you're nuts to ask an ape what they're thinking.
The interactions with the apes are so human-like that it never even crosses your mind when you're interacting with them that this is an unusual question.
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly aware if they don't answer it, just like you would be a small child. But as they get older and they begin to answer it, you assume that they're telling you the answer.
You're talking about your expectations here. This is a huge subject. We're going to come back in just a minute to talk about how do your expectations as a human dealing with another species affect the work you're doing with primates at the Georgia State University Language Research Center? Phil Russell's here. I'm Paula Gordon. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh is our guest, and we're going to be right back. Don't go away.